This is episode 50 of the Fifth Estate podcast, Glenn Thrush and the importance of anonymous sources in journalism.
Hey there, Fifth Estate fans, Neil Doing here, and I'd like to talk to you about our friends at Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Their mission? Make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. They do this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. For less than $10 per person per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes, along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. You can choose from a variety of new recipes each week, or let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. Recipes are not repeated within a year, so you'll never get bored. And Blue Apron's freshness guarantee promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, or they'll make it right. Some of the upcoming meals with Blue Apron include beef teriyaki stir fry with sugar snap peas and lime rice, baked spinach and egg flatbread with sauteed asparagus and lemon aioli, three cheese and baby broccoli stromboli with tomato and oregano dipping sauce, and crispy salmon and roasted potato salad with pickled mustard seeds and creme fraiche sauce. So if that sounds interesting to you, check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/fifth. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/fifth.
All right, it is time for another episode of the Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I am one of your co-hosts along with Mr. Neil Doing. How are you, sir?
Same as I ever am, Jay. The same as I ever am.
Always Mr. Happy, huh?
Frightened, yes. All these things.
Oh, absolutely. So before we get started here, as we always start off the show, one of the things that we like, that we love, is when you go out to iTunes and leave us a review, leave us a rating. That helps us. It makes us feel good. We actually has got some negative ratings over the last couple of weeks.
Awesome. I love any kind of attention. It doesn't matter what kind, positive, negative.
As long as it's attention. So, all right. So over the last few months, since Donald Trump's been elected, there's been a lot of news stories breaking. And a lot of these stories from the Washington Post, the New York Times, Associated Press, a lot of them, in fact, most of them, I would say almost, based a lot on anonymous sources.
Yes, and these anonymous sources, the use of the anonymous sources has come in for some criticism, actually. The sheer rapidity of these stories, the pace at which they are flying, you know, people are beginning to, I think, deflect a little bit. It's easier to complain about anonymous sources than answer what's being said by the anonymous sources.
Correct.
But it's an interesting time.
Certainly is. It's a, with this presidency, journalism has kind of taken there's a big spotlight on it. So we wanted to talk about anonymous sources, and we figured what's the best way to do that than to bring on a journalist who works for one of these publications. And Glenn Thrush of the New York Times is here with us to discuss this. Glenn, thanks for joining us.
Oh, great to be here, guys. Can I ask you a quick question before we start?
Yeah, sure.
Theme music, Coleman Hawkins. Who is it?
No, that is Kansas City Blues of Charlie Parker, written by Miles Davis. So
that was Charlie.
Yes.
Man, that was a fatter tone than late Charlie. Okay, sorry.
No, it's okay. But then again, the whole song is great because you have to hear because Miles is on there as well. So it's like, the whole song is like terrific. So, all right. So, Glenn, before we get started with, the questions and everything, kind of give us You know, give us your background, where you started, how, you know, you became a journalist, all that good stuff. And then we'll start talking about, you know, anonymous sourcing in journalism.
Well, as you know, as a New York Times reporter, I was spawned in the burbling bowels of hell.
Of course.
Sure.
I am from Brooklyn, New York. I am from the unfashionable part of Brooklyn, a part which will never become cool, called Sheepshead Bay, which is a very southern part of Brooklyn. My parents, who are is actually would be my father's 87th birthday today. My father owned a Carvel ice cream store on Brighton Beach Avenue in Brooklyn, and my mother worked in a bunch of different jobs. And I was really raised in a 3 or 4 newspaper household. We just had a lot of newspapers. When I was a kid, we spent part of my childhood on Long Island. So when we were on Long Island, we would get Newsday, the New York Daily News, the New York Post, and the New York Times delivered every day, and then we get a bunch of different weeklies. So I really literally grew up steeped in journalism. The thing that really, I don't think I've ever talked about this before. When I was in fourth grade, for 1 year, my school district got money to do electives. And there was a Newsday reporter who came in to teach journalism at 7 o'clock in the morning before school. And I was a terrible student. I was always a pretty indifferent student. And I was always late for school. But I showed up for that one. And I was the only kid that signed up for that. And after that, you could pay a nickel and get the New York Times. It's kind of like, you know, the drug dealer that gives away the product for free. and I really got hooked. And my, you know, my father was a, you know, every man in my family has ADD or ADHD. And so my dad was the kind of guy who would have 3 radios playing in the house on different news stations. It's just something that's been like the soundtrack of my life. I started off after I got kicked out of Brandeis University, where I made the mistake of being a pre-med, I washed up at Brooklyn College, which turned out to be a great thing for me. I kind of co-majored in poli-sci and Greek classics, 2 majors that are approximately useless. But the guy who ran the folks who ran our college newspaper, the advisors, were all editors and reporters for the New York Post and New York Daily News. So we learned very early on in my late teens and 20s, and this whole group of reporters I worked with, you know, a lot of us stayed in the business, how to really, you know, write a lead, how to cover a story in the proper way, how to figure out how to prioritize fact. But from there, I worked very briefly in Democratic politics. Again, more about geography than anything. There was a congressman whose office, district office, was located above my parents' ice cream store. And I did casework, you know, dealing with like people who had Social Security complaints and stuff like that. I realized pretty early on I didn't want to do politics. And my journalism career was I think the best way to describe it is kind of like every station of the cross, which is I started off in community journalism in Lower Manhattan. For a while, I ran a magazine that covered low-income neighborhoods, poverty, and child welfare in New York City. I've worked for the New York Daily News. I worked for a long time for Newsday, which is a great paper, a great daily that is having, like everyone else, sort of problems. Right. I worked for Bloomberg News. I covered the September 11th attacks in Lower Manhattan and the aftermath for Bloomberg News. I was a freelance magazine writer for the New York Times Magazine, Spin, New York, bunch of different places, the Village Voice, worked briefly for the New York Observer. And then I came down here about 10 years ago to cover Hillary Clinton's 2005 race, jumped over to Politico, where I basically did everything for about 7 years, ending up being our chief political correspondent, and have been at the Times for all of 4.5 months, which seemed like 4.5 years.
Yeah, you got
fairly eventful.
Yeah, but yeah, yes. You've had quite a four month run there for the New York Times. So that's great. You got a really long history of working in journalism. So, to kind of get into the discussion, what we wanted to talk about was, you know, anonymous sources that you know, as Neil and I talked about at the top, you know, it's a big thing now. A lot of criticism of it, because most of the big stories that have come out over the last several months about Donald Trump have been, you know, because of of people who are being anonymously sourced. There's not a lot of people going on the record. So I guess give us your view and kind of let us know, let our audience know what is your personal view of why anonymous sources are important? What is their value?
Well, let me first start off by saying that I probably agree with you guys and a lot of your listeners out there that I think it stinks. I mean, I think the use and overuse of anonymous sourcing is a significant problem and a symptom of a race to the bottom in journalism. I mean, I wish we could get people who would talk on the record more freely and felt as if they could express themselves on the record. I think it gets, the anonymous sourcing and background sourcing, and there are all different categories, 31 flavors of anonymous sourcing, right? If you just kind of look at the pool reports coming from the president's trip overseas, you have officials who are refusing to be identified on the record saying the most banal positive things about the trip. So it is an enormously overused tool. Now, the problem is one of unilateral disarmament. In order to get people to communicate and in order to get people to tell the truth and to be candid, particularly when they feel that their jobs could be at risk, you have to offer them the veil of anonymity. In the course of my career, it has just become a lot more prevalent for people to demand that. So I think what people have to understand when they're reading these stories is there's a certain supply and demand element, and the demand is from the source base. Once you start granting anonymity to people, it's very hard to stop. And so you have a demand on the part of sources to try to obtain anonymity when they can. So the reporting process, actually my reporting process hasn't really changed fundamentally. I have a lot of off-the-record conversations with people in a relaxed way so I can find out what the hell is going on first. And then the process is trying to bring them onto the record, right? So you have, when you first start to report a story and have a thesis, you want to talk to 15 or 20 people. You want to have them be relaxed enough to sort of tell you what the truth is so that you can determine what the fact set is and how you ought to report this thing. And then you begin this process of pulling them arduously back onto the record. That process of trying to pull people onto the record has become a lot more time consuming over the course of my career.
Mm-hmm. And so, Glenn, you say you have your own kind of process for cultivating these sources and drawing them out. Does the New York Times have a policy on the use of anonymous sources? Are there restrictions placed on you, or is it sort of just as the situation demands?
Oh no, we have a pretty strict protocol. I'll be honest with you, I'm not as acquainted with how far what is occurring in the upper levels of my organization, but I know what is required of me in terms of my interactions with the editors that I deal with day to day, and that is I have to come up with a reasonable explanation as to why these people can't or won't be quoted on the record. For my assigning editor, I have to provide the names of the individuals. I typically don't do that in writing. I do that verbally just so that there's not a record to protect them. And in I would say a fair number of the cases, I am then told to go back and either request that they put it on the record or obtain additional sourcing that verifies what the individual said. So it is a very lively and sometimes contentious interactions I have with editors regarding this stuff. So this is not, this is on a lot of these stories, particularly these large narratives that I do individually and with my partner most frequently, Maggie Haberman, we have a lot of agita, a lot of the, of our stomach pain comes from having to litigate whether or not we can use various things, and our editor's constantly pushing us to get people to come on the record.
So it's not just that the New York Times has got an axe to grind and they want to push their narrative, regardless of whether a source will go on the record. There is a vetting process that goes into these things. You guys are careful.
And every place I've worked, Politico included, had a protocol. Now, Politico which I think of as being, I come out of the tabloid culture in New York, Newsday and the New York Daily News. Politico I view more, and I mean this in a really positive way. I don't think people outside of New York really understand that when you say tabloid, it's a positive, right? But Politico is really much more of a national political tabloid. So the rules tend to be a touch looser. And I'll give you an example. Politico, if you notice, when you read a Politico story, you will often see the first quote in the story being anonymous. That is something that we don't do here. It was something I tended not to do at Politico either, but I don't cast aspersions on it, but I'm just illustrating the difference. You won't tend to see that in the New York Times or the Washington Post. In fact, I don't believe, I've been here 4.5 months, I don't believe I've had an anonymous quote in any of my stories. So that is where you kind of see the variation. And I think as a consumer of news, I am more leery of, particularly if it's a quote that's critical of somebody, I'm not a big fan of letting people shoot from the bushes. You know what I mean? I think if you're going to say something negative about somebody, you do it with your name attached in the public square so that you can take the consequences.
Well, and that leads me sort of to my next question. It's sort of on the flip side there. What in your experience do you find are the like common motivations for acting as an anonymous source? You know, we get a sense that the reporter gets a story, the paper gets a story. But what's really in it for the source to contribute something anonymously like that?
Yeah, that's an absolutely great question. And I think it depends on the story. For instance, I think, and again, I just want to make it very clear. I have no knowledge of what sources any reporter other than Glenn Thrush has. Like, just like everybody else, I read a New York Times story or an Adam Entos story in the Washington Post and wonder, well, how the hell did they get that, right? Who did they talk to? And you can try to guess it, right? There's kind of an honor code in the newsroom that you don't sort of ask people about that kind of thing because they want to shield folks from retribution. For instance, if you're talking about a story, I think some of these intelligence leaks, and again, I'm going more from sort of published accounts of this stuff and things other reporters have said in public forums. My sense is there are a cohort of people who have a public service component where they feel. Where they feel as if either this administration or in some cases the Obama administration, definitely sort of on the Chelsea Manning stuff and warrantless wiretapping. That was something that there were a lot of leaks in the Obama administration. Obama didn't like it. I think so there are some public servants who have an axe to grind. I think there are people, I think some of your listeners will probably view that as being politically motivated, but a lot of the people, for instance, who leak information about new environmental regs that EPA might be proposing, for instance. They're probably not conservatives, but I believe they believe that they're behaving in the public interest. So I think it's a combination of people who believe they're behaving in the public interest, some political motivations. There are times, frankly, when you have folks who have axes to grind, and it is your job as a reporter to discern that. And then there are people who we contact in order to do, which is much more up my alley, to reconstruct events. You know, we're sort of historians in real time. And they are more likely to request anonymity simply because they're not authorized to talk and they won't be nearly as candid. I'll give you a quote that I think is one that I recall with some trepidation, but also fondness. There was a very good communication staffer who worked for Barack Obama named Ben LaBolt, known for his sharp elbows and his sense of humor. And Ben used to say jokingly that on the record is where the truth goes to die. And what he meant by that is, I can tell you something on the record and won't be nearly as candid as something I could tell you on background. So there's a whole range of reasons, and it is our job in terms of professional responsibility, and we do take it seriously, believe it or not, not to let people dump crap on other people for personal or political motives. We've got to try to discern whether or not this stuff is true. And oftentimes, and this is why, here's another thing I'd like to explain to your listeners, particularly those who are skeptical of the mainstream media, you will notice that at the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal, there are a lot of reporting teams, a lot of two-person reporting teams. The reason that is because as things have become more contentious, and as this situation, particularly with the Trump administration, has become more fluid, we need to both be calling the same people or just expand the larger circle of people that we call. People made fun of the Washington Post a couple of weeks ago now, I think, but, you know, saying essentially that they had talked to 30 people on a story. But while that can seem a little excessive, that's the point. In order to make sure what you're hearing and what you're publishing is true, you can't rely on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 people. You oftentimes have to talk to a dozen or 2 dozen people about the same event. And I call it the Rashomon process, which is named after an ancient Japanese story in which the story is told from the 10 different perspectives of people who viewed a murder. You need to speak with any number of people, and in the course of interviewing those people, factor in what their biases may be and attempt to distill it and synthesize it into something that approaches the truth. I hope that was a long answer for a short question.
No, that was fascinating. It, you know, it's something that not a lot of people actually have practical experience doing. So it's good to get that information. So when you are working with these sources, you know, in talking about working with a partner and that sort of thing, you explained a little bit about checking it against people's biases. But what other kind of confirmation do you get when working with these sources? Do you run down the leads that they've given you, or fact check some of the stuff they've told you? Do you just compare it to what other people are saying?
Yeah, the thing you have to do, and I think, you know, I taught journalism probably for 6 or 7 years at NYU and Columbia, and what I am, and you can ask Sean Spicer this, if ever you have Sean on. I am a hawk for the back end of this process. I tend to want to involve the public relations people fairly early on in the process of reporting. Now, I'm not casting aspersions on what other people do. There are a lot of people a lot of reporters will have a 48-hour or 24-hour window. Look, if news is breaking, sometimes we only give people a couple of hours or an hour sometimes if it's competitive. But if I'm working on a longer piece with a lot of moving parts, I'm going to give people days. And part of my process, and I've gotten in trouble for it, just look up, Google my name and WikiLeaks and John Podesta, is I tend to be very thorough on the back end about letting people know who are the target of my story precisely what is in it so that they can confirm or deny specific details.
Which seemed pretty courteous to me, I'll be honest. If I was the target of a news story, I'd want that kind of treatment.
But it's not, can I be honest with you? It is less out of courtesy than my own anxiety. I am the night before I publish a big story, and it's not the night anymore. We tend to pop them in the afternoon. Very, very tough time for me because personally, you never, when you're dealing with a story that has dozens of facts in it, and you're making assertions about conversations you didn't witness, getting something wrong is very easy, and you don't want to be in that position where you're impugning someone's reputation or writing something unfair about them. And again, it's very hard for people who are kind of outside to understand how important that is to the good practitioners of this stuff. We don't want to screw people. We don't want to be unfair. We did not get into this business and sacrifice years of our lives and screw our families in terms of downtime in order to get stuff wrong. I mean, so my back end process with people is very arduous, very rigorous, simply because I want to be able to sleep the night before a story gets published. I have a high anxiety threshold on that stuff, and I don't want to feel crappy.
that's great to hear. Okay, so we're talking to Glenn Thrush of New York Times about anonymous sourcing. We're going to take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll finish our conversation with Glenn right after a word from one of our sponsors.
Hey there, folks. It's Neil Dewing, and I want to take a minute to tell you about our friends at Dollar Shave Club. Dollar Shave Club is the smarter choice. You will get a great shave at a great price, conveniently delivered right to your door. It's really a no-brainer. No longer do you have to schlep to the store to buy a cheap disposable razor that gives you a cheap shave. Neither do you have to spend a fortune on razors with gimmicky shaving tech that you don't need. I myself use Dollar Shave Club. Now, for several months out of the year, I go bearded. But when I do shave, I find Dollar Shave Club delivers a smooth, sleek, really quite attractive result. And when I use my Dollar Shave Club Executive Razor with their Dr. Carver's Shave Butter, the blade glides ever so gently and gives me such a smooth shave. Plus, their Dr. Carver's Shave Butter is transparent for a more precise shave, which helps prevent ingrown hairs and fights razor bumps. Now, listeners to the Fifth Estate can make the smarter choice by joining Dollar Shave Club. For a limited time, new members get their first month of the Executive Razor with a tube of their Dr. Carver's Shave Butter for only $5 with free shipping. After that, razors are just a few bucks a month. This is a $15 value for only $5. In your first month box, you get an awesome weighty handle, a full cassette of four cartridges, and a tube of their shave butter. After your first month, replacement cartridges ship automatically at their regular price. There are no hidden fees and no commitments. Cancel anytime you like. You can only get this offer exclusively at dollarshaveclub.com/fifth. That's dollarshaveclub.com/fifth.
All right, and we're back. We're talking again with Glenn Frost of the New York Times about anonymous sourcing. So, Glenn, has an anonymous source ever kind of provided like the smoking gun for a story, or is it more like they point you in the right direction? And, you know, I guess we're almost quoting from All the President's Men at this time, saying, well, you know, I'll point you in the right direction. I'll let you know you're doing okay, but I'm not going to give you everything. Is it like that? Or has somebody said to you, I've got something, this is big, but, you know, I can't go on the record for this, and it turns out to be, you know, something huge? Or is it, you know, how does that work? Or has it ever happened?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, oftentimes, look, you know, the biggest stories that tend to have the most impact are the ones that have a paper trail, right? So, for instance, we've seen some pretty damaging reporting based on sort of the memo that James Comey kept of his Oval Office discussions with the president. Now, even though we didn't publish the memo, the fact that it is rooted in a written source gives that sort of a bombshell more veracity. And we've also seen these, and by the way, guys, I think it's amazing. I've never seen anything like it. These leaked readouts and transcripts of the president's conversations with foreign leaders. This is unprecedented. I can't recall a single instance this happened under Obama. But so on these big stories, it tends to emanate from either something written or something verifiable in terms of writing. So, and that tends to be what I like to call a motivated source, someone who is contacting you for a specific reason, which gets back again to their vision of public service, which others might call politics. But again, the difficulty with written sources, again, is providing and reporting out to ascertain their veracity. But in general, yeah, that's the way it works. When you have an off-the-record conversation with people and they tell you something, and you know, we like to keep it pretty casual so that people speak to us more, then you are free to go chase it with other people. And to track things down. But oftentimes, the individual will give you, particularly if you're building sort of a narrative, as I have tended to do for the past few years in my life, you know, it's more like mosaics on a wall. So each small piece creates, at the end, a larger picture. Earlier on in my career, when I was doing investigative work or investigative reconstructions, for instance, I worked with a team of really great reporters at Newsday that wrote about the causes of this terrible ferry crash in 2003 in New York, Staten Island ferry crash. You know, that was based on sort of a lot of tips, human intelligence, leaks, and so on. And over the course of covering campaigns, you get those kinds of things too. But in general, again, it's kind of a mixed bag. And again, it depends on the motivations of the people who want to tell you stuff.
So, okay, so what, all right, so that's pretty important. So has Have you ever had a situation where an anonymous source turned out to be wrong, or you got burned on something? Has that ever happened, or is it, if it happened, was it just a matter of something that, that took place, or has anybody purposely fed you poor information? Have you ever experienced that?
You know, it's funny. It hasn't really happened to me in terms of somebody, because I think it's really important for you, it's really important to pop. To pop something you know is true. I know it sounds like a dodge, but no, I haven't really been. Look, there are people who have lied to me and told me inaccurate information, but mostly that's been picked up by my process. Like, I can tell if somebody's full of it. Like, the main thing about it is, if it seems like it's too good to be true, it's too good to be true. And if you're a good reporter and you run your traps, you know, it works that way. Now, when I ran a blog for Politico and I ran our Hill blog for a while, you'll occasionally get kind of one-offs. And I remember one specific incident where a flack on Capitol Hill, a Republican communications person, gave me a transcript of an MSNBC interview with then-Congressman Tom Perriello, who's now running for the Democratic nomination for governor of Virginia. And it turned out this spokesperson doctored the transcript to omit information that made Tom's quote sound more real. You know, his quote, I forget the exact topic of the quote, but the version that was given to me was damning. And I ran a blog item on it without checking with Perriello because I thought I had the transcript. It turned out that was doctored and it was used in campaign ads, and Perriello lost. Now, it had nothing to do, I don't think the loss had anything to do with me. But the way that I handled it is, as soon as I found out I'd gotten it wrong, I put in massive type correction. I wrote an apology to Perriello, and I outed the staffer who did it. And I never answered a call from him. And I sent he was a prominent Hill staffer. I'm not going to name him. And I sent an email to my entire company, and I said, "Don't believe a damn word that this person says." So, you know, that and that gets back to the larger issues that we're talking about. Because we live in an age with so much as anonymous sourcing, it is all the more important to make sure you get this stuff right and you're not taking shots at people and that you're giving people the opportunity to respond. Because if you're going to play in this environment where you are demanding trust of your readers, you've got to earn that trust.
Well, and Glenn, I think we've touched on this a little bit, but, you know, there are really some risks that these journalists like yourself face when you put your word out there, when you're trying to relate a story. You know, what are some of those pitfalls that face these journalists who use anonymous sources, and what's the best way to manage those risks? We've talked about your process, yep. But you know, how do you respond, or how do you deal with, you know, questions about credibility, for instance?
That's a good question. I think, you know, the sad thing is we're in an era where people don't trust institutions, right? And there's a good reason why they don't. The one thing I would say is, if you look at the paper I'm working at, the New York Times, and you look at, for instance, the way that we dealt with the run-up to the invasion of Iraq and the weapons of mass destruction issue, you know, there were very clearly issues with our process in terms of vetting information and sources on that. It turned out that the information that had been published by a couple of reporters was later deemed to have been false, and that the sources of those stories were deemed insufficiently authoritative, or people who had an axe to grind, and that erodes the credibility of our business and our paper, or it eroded the credibility of our paper. But I would caution people to understand that those kinds of mistakes, as horrific as they are, actually build capacity and a desire among the editors of places like this to get it right the next time. I know that look, that's cold comfort for people. But I think what people outside our business and outside our process don't really understand, because they think, they assume that people are, everything is politically motivated and everyone is cynical. I think what people really fail to understand is how committed we are generally speaking, to getting this stuff right. And again, a long answer to a short question, I think the answer is editorial. The answer is having good, strong editors who ask the reporters questions about sourcing and to have clear policies in the understanding that occasionally you're going to have to bend it, bend the policies. But you need to have a process in which every box is checked and all the decisions are being made consciously. You can't just have autopilot on stuff. So the answer to that is yes. You got to have reporters who are trained properly and have a good process. But you got to have editors who are paying attention. I think, again, it comes down, it's like pilots. You know, you need to have good pilots and you need to have good air traffic controllers.
It's a good analogy. So let me ask you about this. What kind of pressure do you get? I mean, do you get pressure from the White House at all about anonymous sources? And, you know, what, you know, the pressure, talk about the pressure to reveal sources versus, you know, your need to protect your sources. How does that work?
Well, some of the people who give us, well, let me put it this way. A lot of the people who complain loudest about anonymous sources, and I will start with the President of the United States himself, have themselves spent a good portion of their careers being anonymous sources. Right? I mean, what I'm saying here is not opinion. It is not a slur. The President of the United States in his previous incarnation called all of us who covered New York City for 25 years and was served as an anonymous.
I remember those stories.
Yeah, no doubt about that.
He'd call and spread rumors about who he was dating and stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, look, and he's, you know, and actually I think, you know, we take a lot of guff for being really tough on him. But, you know, I give Donald Trump a lot of credit. I covered Barack Obama. He is 10 times more personally accessible than Barack Obama. During press conferences, he is willing to take on tougher questions on a day-to-day basis than any president I've ever covered. He is much more similar to a mayor in New York than he is to a president in that regard. And I don't think he gets nearly enough credit from us for that. Because we listen, you know, we take him at his word on all this enemy of the people nonsense and stuff. When in fact, the way he behaves is extremely engaged with the press. So I think he, the truth of the matter is he deserves a lot of credit on that. But in terms of like the complaints on anonymous sourcing, I think the more serious allegations have to do with our national security reporting. And I can tell you that on the political side, we're very diligent. On the national security side, that is an entirely more just a more involved process that involves multiple contacts with administration and agency officials. So we take that stuff seriously as well. So I don't think what the average reader, even the educated reader at the Times, I don't think readers are fully read into the sheer amount of interaction and negotiation that goes on for most stories.
Oh, and, you know, and of course, you know, everybody knows that President Trump sat down with you and Maggie to do an interview. So, I mean, it's like you said, he's happy to sit there and kind of talk to the press, but at the same time, he wants to, you know, kind of bash him on the other side. But he's happy to have them around, though.
Yeah. And just like him, you know, obviously our consequences are not as significant, but we are judged on results. If our stories are wrong, and we're getting it wrong, you're going to know it. And if the president truly believed that we were getting it wrong and out to get him, why would he communicate with us? I mean, there are a lot of reporters at the New York Times he could talk to rather than talk to Maggie or me. And he talks to almost everybody on the White House team. He's accused at any given time all of us of kind of making stuff up and fake news and all that stuff. But I think, again, his actions speak more loudly than what he says about us.
I agree. Well, Glenn, so thank you so much for all of that. Before we have one more question we'll have to get to. It's our one gotcha question. But I did want to ask you this. Given your background and everything, you worked at Newsday, you worked at New York Daily News. I'm certain that you've seen the movie. It's probably about 23 years old now. The Paper with Michael Keaton and Glenn Close. What did you think about that?
You know,
that?
I, Well, my best friend, you know, I have never seen the entire movie because I kind of watched it and I was like, oh, all right. It's like, it must be like a ball player watching Bull Durham. I think that's kind of right, but it's not, you know. My best friend, who was, I think, deputy city editor at the time, a guy named Jerry Hester, one of the great newsmen around, great old-time newsmen. He's in the middle of that thing. The movie that motivated me more than anything. Actually, the two movies that are, to me, are like the best journalism movies are All the President's Men, blah, 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 right? Everybody loves that. But I also love broadcast news. Did you guys remember that from the 80s?
With William Hurt and
Brooks and Albert Brooks.
Right, Albert Brooks.
How incredibly goofy and earnest and self-obsessed journalists are.
Spotlight, I assume you probably like that one as well. I mean,
Spotlight was terrific, and every reporter who covers politics watched the Spotlight and said, "Oh, I wish I had a real job. What am I doing with my life?"
a real job. You know, what's funny was
why,
you know,
am I not out there? Why am I going to press conferences?
And the best part about that is that they got most of that movie. They made it so compelling, them digging around in the basement of the thing, looking at, you know, Catholic Church brochures of where priests were. I mean, it was that kind of thing, and looking at and doing spreadsheets, you know, so to come up with numbers and everything. So it was interesting how they were able to make that so compelling.
Well, it is. I mean, that's why we're in the business, you know. Like, I started off doing that stuff, and part of my job is still sort of that kind of sleuthing. But it is, if that inspired a dozen sharp kids around the country to get into this business, that would have done a great service, you know.
Yeah, I agree. All right, so
Glenn, we really do appreciate you coming on with us to discuss this, because I think it is, as I said earlier, it's something that people don't really understand, and I certainly learned quite a bit. So, you know, sincerely appreciative of that. However, there is one final test that you must pass, one great trial that we lay at your feet, a burden that you must pick up and carry. And this is...
If this involves me saying anything nice about Chipper Jones, I
am out of here. No.
Fear not. We're not sadists. Don't worry. But it's it is a matter of vital cultural importance, however. And the answer that you give matters. I will caution you. Jay and I disagree on this subject very strongly. Yes. And so there's a right and a wrong answer. But we will accept you no matter how you answer. So, Glenn Thrush, is the television show Seinfeld overrated? Is it overrated?
I have a super strong opinion about this.
Express it, sir.
I actually have, like, first I need to tell you that I went to the same high school as Larry David.
Uh-oh.
Sheepshead Bay High School in Brooklyn, and everybody who went to that school is exactly like Larry David. Miserable, rotten. I think Seinfeld is horrendously overrated.
Oh my gosh. Whoa. New Yorker saying this. Wow.
Curveball.
We are yanking. Your New York card is getting yanked. I mean, that's just going to be it.
No, my friends. No, my friends. Hear me out. Hear me out.
Okay.
I'm listening.
Look. I don't dislike, I mean, I wouldn't say I hate Seinfeld. There's some parts. No, of Elaine dancing, for instance, is amazing. Yeah. There's a scene with the George and a cleaning woman on a desk that will never be scraped from my memory. But Curb Your Enthusiasm is the gold standard, man. Like, the first three seasons of Curb Your Enthusiasm are the best TV ever made. And it's the real stuff. It's like Miller Lite. I wouldn't say Miller Lite. I don't want to name brands. I'm sorry. Miller Lite is a great brand. And they'll be. I know they'll be coming for me in Atlanta on that one. But I mean, like, no. I just. It's like light beer versus real beer, man. Like, Curb Your Enthusiasm is just the best. It's just, it's, now Seinfeld is pretty good, but you know.
Man, I thought I had it in the bag with a Brooklyn native. I was like, I'm sitting there saying to myself, Neil's gonna lose on this one, and
well,
he wins.
It just goes no, to no. show you. Just goes to show you, Jay. You can never assume. You can never assume that you know the answers that people are gonna give.
That is true.
Wait,
that
so Jay, true. Jay, I heard a rumor that you are from my neck of the woods. Where are you from originally?
I am from Queens, from the Sunnyside area. Sunnyside, Queens.
Sunnyside. I think of Sunnyside as being more Irish than Italian.
Yeah, well, it was a mixture. I mean, there was Irish, Italian, Korean. You know, there was the melting pot. The only thing that was weird about me growing up in that area is I grew up a Yankees fan surrounded by Mets fans.
Well, you're talking to a Mets fan, my friend.
See, that's what you get for dissing Seinfeld. Suffering as a Mets fan.
I'm sitting right now looking, and I let you go, but I'm sitting right now looking at a New York Post cover that I have pinned to my cubicle from May 12th that says, "Why does God hate the Mets?"
Yes, so it's an interesting thing.
I will not tell you the dates because I want to protect my family's safety, but I'm going to be down there early next month, and I cannot wait to see that new stadium.
Oh, okay. Well, are you going? You're obviously going to a game. So, yeah, that'll be cool. Good luck with the traffic. That'll be fun. I don't know if you've ever been subject to Atlanta traffic, but you know it's terrible.
I also like Gunsmoke, but you didn't ask me about that.
So. Okay. Well, Glenn, thanks again so much for being on. It was really great hearing what you had to say, the stories that you were telling, the process, everything. It was really illuminating, and we really appreciate it.
Great fun, guys. Take care.
All right. And as we talked about before, that's, you know, we appreciate you going out to iTunes and leaving us a rating, telling us how much you appreciate us. Neil loves it. And like I said, remember, even
as
negative.
As much as I can love anything.
Yeah, even the negative stuff he likes. So it's like, it all counts. I don't know if negative stuff helps, but it's all there. But we prefer positive. Positivity is something we strive for. Anyway, that's going to do it for this episode of The Fifth Estate. I'm Jay Caruso. For my co-host, Neil Dewing, we'll see you next time on The Fifth Estate.